This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jay McInerney's first novel, Bright Lights, Big City, was about the young people of his generation immersed in the New York nightlife of the 80s. His latest novel, The Last of the Savages, examines the generation that preceded him. The novel opens in 1965 and follows the lives of two young men of opposite backgrounds and temperaments who become best friends at a New England boarding school. Patrick Keene is from a working-class family in New England. His goal is to play by the rules, become a lawyer, and reach the upper levels of the establishment. Will Savage is from a prominent, wealthy family with deep roots in Memphis, and he wants to cut loose. He's white, but obsessed with black music. He becomes a record producer whose excessive appetites make him the subject of legend. Patrick, who is repressed, watches Will and the rest of the counterculture from a distance. I asked Jay McInerney if he understands the character's opposing impulses, one to enter the establishment, the other to subvert it.
I think that there's a way in which I split myself in half with these characters. I certainly identify more with Will, or I initially did. I don't feel that I've led the conventional life. My politics aren't conservative as Patrick's are, and yet as I got farther into the book, initially Patrick was almost a device, a narrative device for telling Will's story. But as the book went along, I got more and more interested in him. Patrick is someone who self-consciously admires the outlaw soul of his best friend, but can't follow him down that road.
Both of the characters in this book are reinventing themselves. Patrick, the person from the lower middle class family who wants to become part of the Ivy League and part of the establishment, he's reinventing himself to be a person of pedigree. And Will, who's from the South and from a well-known family there, is reinventing himself as a radical, as a music person. Why is reinvention such a classic theme in American fiction? It seems so many really good novels and so many great classic American novels are about reinvention.
Yeah, I think it's the great American theme. We all came over here to start fresh. We came to this great tabula rasa of a country, or at least that was how we saw it. And certainly as somebody who writes about New York, as someone who loves New York, the whole reason for New York's existence is a stage for people to come and to reinvent themselves.
What personal relevance does that theme of self-reinvention have for you?
Well, I guess I fled from the background that, from my own background, I guess that I, like Patrick, I'm Irish Catholic, although I didn't come from, my father was a very successful business executive. Everyone in my family for generations has been in banking or in business. And I was horrified by the idea of following in their footsteps. I was in my callow, youthful way, I felt very superior to my hardworking, accomplished forebears, and I wanted nothing more than to, flee the suburbs, move to the city, become a bohemian, smoke French cigarettes, and write in cafes.
Well, I think you write really well about how if you're trying to reinvent yourself, your parents are a real problem.
Oh, they're all, yeah.
They're evidence of who you were and where you're from.
Yeah, you can't. they tend to pop up at the wrong times and to kind of compromise your whatever act you may be trying to pull off.
There's a passage I'd like you to read, and this is early on in the book, and it's about the main character Patrick's feelings of embarrassment when his working class or lower middle class parents take him to prep school, and as he says, he's begun to disown them in his heart.
Indeed. I should preface this by saying this is not a description of my own mother, God rest her soul. But I think it's I think it's typical of I guess Patrick would be about 15, 16 at this time. My mother is, shall we say, a noticeable woman. Nearly 6 feet tall, she has a bust like the prow of a ship. The fact that she had always been a doting and devoted mother did not prevent me from feeling, somewhere around the dawn of puberty, acutely embarrassed by her sheer physical volume, bright clothing, and clarion voice, its broad, adenoidal vowels redolent of the tenements of South Boston. She compounded the crime of being the parent of an adolescent by being so damnably conspicuous. My father, as if to compensate, tended to recede. He is, in fact, 2 inches shorter than my mother, and this, too, was a source of chagrin. Fathers were supposed to be taller, and, when visiting their sons' prep schools, were not supposed to wear checked sports jackets worn shiny at the elbows, nor polyester ties. This much, even I knew. I was, in short, an ungrateful little twerp.
Did you ever have the sense when you were younger that when your parents were really embarrassing you or giving clues about who you really were before you started becoming the person who you wanted to be, that you were being really ungrateful at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the, if that description and others like it has any force, it comes out of a sense of acute mortification on my part about several incidents. The one that I remember best, I think, is when my parents took me to college. I went to Williams in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and I was not a preppy. Many of the guys at Williams and the women at Williams were from Andover and Exeter and Hotchkiss and so on. And I'd come from a public school, so I was kind of self-conscious about that. And I was a little younger than everybody. I was 17, and I was just dying to start my new life, and I couldn't wait for my old life to begin and my new life to start. And I remember my parents bringing me, and I remember my mother's consternation about essentially losing me. And even though I knew how bad she felt, I just could not wait to get rid of her. Couldn't wait to get her out of the dorm. Didn't want my new friends to see them for some reason, although my parents were incredibly presentable, both very attractive people. And their hearts were to some extent breaking about this radical change in their life, and they're losing their son to the larger world. And I was just all I could think about was how to get them into the car and get them the hell off the campus. And I remember as they drove away, turning away and not waving. And I don't know what, you know, I mean, when I look back on that, I still cringe. I'm blushing right now.
Let me ask you to read the very first sentence of your novel, The Last of the Savages.
Well, it is kind of pertinent. I think I can do it from, I don't have to find it. The capacity for friendship is God's way of apologizing for our families.
Now, how'd you come up with that, and why did you lead the book with it?
Well, the book really is about friendship. And as you've already pointed out, the primary motive of Patrick Keene and Will Savage, I guess, is an attempt to flee their backgrounds, their families, an attempt to reinvent themselves. And I guess just because I think it's true. it certainly seems to resonate with a lot of people. But I think I think that you know, that there's the old cliche that, you know, you can't choose your family. That's what makes friendship so interesting, I think, as a subject. Here's our attempt to do something in the area where we have some control, choosing our friends.
So did your feelings about family give you any reservations about becoming a father yourself?
Well, no. In fact, quite the opposite. I tend to write about really dysfunctional families, but actually mine was pretty functional. I have to say, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that because writers are not supposed to have happy and conventional family lives. But my parents were happily married for as long as my mother was alive. And unfortunately for all of us, she died almost 20 years ago now. And my father, who I had not been so close to when my mother was alive, became kind of mother and father figure after my mother died. And so I actually had a wonderful example. We're a fairly close family, and we haven't had any of those terrible traumas. We haven't been riven by divorce. And if anything, I felt like maybe I ought to try and pass it along. So I was, you know, I was lucky to have a pretty good model. And I was also lucky that my my children were born, one of them named after my father, about 9 months before my father died, so that he got to see them. It somehow seems very, like a very good thing that I didn't wait any longer than I did.
I'm wondering what your father thought after you had reinvented yourself, when you became known as, you know, the cool young writer who made the club scene back in the 80s. Did your father recognize that character?
No, he didn't really recognize that character at first. And also, on the one hand, he wanted to, I suppose he wanted me to reassure him that everything I was doing was fiction. And on the other hand, he would take issue with anything that he didn't think squared with his notion of my biography. You know, he would complain when I said something about a father figure that he felt misrepresented him. I think it must have been tough for him. I had a very strange notoriety after the publication of my first book. And I'm not sure that many parents would have wanted to claim me as a son in my public incarnation any more than, you know, I at one time wanted to claim them.
It, my son is the novel who writes about the characters who go to clubs and do cocaine, right?
Okay, yeah. But it's all fiction.
He doesn't know anything about it.
He just researched it at the library. Yeah. Now, it was very... I think it was tough for him, and it was tough, you know, and he had to explain to the relatives that, you know, the language was a little dicey and so on, but Jay didn't really mean it, so I thought for a long time that he really didn't approve of my career, and I caught him several times asking, you know, wives and girlfriends of mine when I was actually going to settle down and get a real job. You know, this at a time when it was clear that I was quite successful at what I was doing. And it upset me, I think, that I felt he didn't take what I was doing seriously. And then on the other hand, I discovered when he died last fall, I went through all of his effects, of course, and he had the most extraordinary collection of press clippings on me that I will ever see. I mean, he had virtually everything from every city in the United States and Europe. And because my father, for most of his life, was in charge of a sales force of some 60, 70 people. So he had salesmen all over the country and really all over the world, and they'd all send him this stuff. And he would very carefully file it and annotate it, save it. He had all the books and all the editions. And I was, you know, naturally very touched when I discovered this, because I just assumed somehow that he really didn't approve. And I, you know, I can't say that I blame him. So it was nice to know that he was really keeping track and that he was apparently appreciative.
I want to ask you something else about your novel, The Last of the Savages. Uh-huh. Part of the book is about the narrator's experiences when he goes south to visit with his friend Will, and Will's from an old Southern family, used to be slave owners. So Patrick has to get an understanding of the South the wealthy white people in the South, that sense of family lineage that those wealthy white families have. And this part of the novel is set in Memphis and the Mississippi Delta. I know you live part of the time in Tennessee. What's it been like for you to live part of the time in the South after many years in Manhattan? And, you know, what did you draw on from your own experiences for that part of the book?
Well, it's this book certainly wouldn't exist if I hadn't been spending some part of the last 4 years in the South, in my case, outside of Nashville, Tennessee, which is quite a different city than Memphis. On the other hand, all my life I've been, or not all my life, but for a lot of my life I've been interested in the blues and in rhythm and blues and in the music that comes out of the Mississippi Delta and Memphis. I used to make pilgrimages down there when I was in college, later in life, to sort of search for the music, to find the music. It seems to me that the blues really is the great American folk art form of the 20th century. And so it's interesting for me when I moved down there. I'd also been a Civil War buff when I was a kid. And so moving to the South was kind of fascinating to me. I married someone from an old Southern family. Mm-hmm. And I'd always had an interest in the literature of the South, the music, the history. I also couldn't help getting more historically self-conscious when I started spending time in the South. When people in the South, in our part of the South, talk about the war, I mean, they don't mean, you know, Vietnam or World War II. They mean the one that ended in 1865. And you know, I live in a house that was built before the Civil War and that sits on the edge of a battlefield. You know, I sometimes dig up, you know, belt buckles and bullets. All of this kind of extended my time horizon, I guess. Suddenly I was living in a place where there was a real sense of continuity, of history, of tradition. You know, families going back three generations were in a place like Nashville are considered real new arrivistes. And I think all of this was reflected in the book, which really starts in 1965, but it really does look back to the Civil War. Will's kind of obsessed with his family's slave-owning past. And
have you met people like that in the South who are obsessed with it?
I have, yeah. Yeah, I have. Will is a little unusual in being, I mean, he's a real maverick figure who feels like it's his personal job to atone for all of that history, and who feels that, you know, who feels closer, really, to the black people around him than to the white people. The book is also partly about race, and that's something that you think much more about in the South. And I have to say that the races exist in much closer proximity in the South. Things are closer to the surface there as well. And it's fascinating as a, you know, as a Yankee, which I certainly am, as a New Yorker, to be thrust into this very different environment. And I guess that a lot of the book really arose from that collision of cultures for me.
Now, you're the father of twins now. Your twins will have a...
be able to read my books.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But they're going to have a genetic connection to a part of history that's really foreign to you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That Southern lineage, that Southern white, wealthy, politically connected lineage. Is that going to be strange for you to know that they're connected by blood to something that you feel a real stranger to?
No, actually, I'm glad for them to have kind of roots that I didn't have. My father was very peripatetic in his career. He was always getting transferred, changing jobs. But I'm grateful that my kids will have those kind of roots if they want them. You know, that they can at least spend part of their life in a place where their ancestors go back 200 years, where the streets are named after their great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers. You know, I kind of envy that. I wish that I really came from someplace, but I don't feel that I do. I'm kind of a rootless American.
Jay McInerney, we're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jay McInerney's latest novel is called The Last of the Savages. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.